Robin Young, it's here and now. Tomorrow, the fledgling Iraqi government takes legal custody of prisoner of war Saddam Hussein, who will still be held in an American prison in Iraq. Here's Prime Minister Iyad Alawi today.
We assure you that it will be a just trial and a fair trial, unlike the trials that he inflicted on his enemies, on the Iraqi people.
Also today, an Iraqi special tribunal issued arrest and detention warrants for the former dictator and 11 other prominent figures in his regime. For more on this and the latest on the hostages being held in Iraq, we're joined by Dan Murphy. He's correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. He's in Baghdad. And Dan, is this going to be any kind of a public or physical handover of Saddam tomorrow?
No, there will be no physical movement of him. He'll remain in U.S. military custody. What it amounts to is a signing of a legal paper that says formal legal authority transfers to Iraqis from the United States. On Thursday, it seems as if there's going to be an arraignment before an Iraqi judge. I can't figure out yet if it's going to be public, but if it is, that could be very interesting if there's images on him on local TV facing a judge, and we'll see how Iraqis react to that.
Right. Why were arrest warrants issued for Hussein or former Deputy Prime Minister Tariq Aziz and others if they're already being detained?
It's a bit of a legal formality. Until now, they've had status as prisoners of war because they were in U.S. custody under U.S. occupation. Now that there's a sovereign Iraq, there needs to be something that covers a continued detention of this man, given that the U.S. doesn't have the right to hold him anymore. And so the Iraqis are just going through some of the formalities to make that possible.
And by the way, I'm assuming that's just a car alarm or something behind you. Dan, how soon would these men face trial?
I think it's going to be some months before trial begins, and it could drag on for some time. If you look at the Milosevic trial, that's been going on for 2 years. I don't think it'll last that long, but there'll probably be at least 6 months before he's brought to justice.
Meanwhile, Dan, there are hostages who have been taken by Iraqi insurgents or terrorist groups. We understand 3 Turkish hostages were released today. Why them and not others?
I think it's quite clear because they were Muslims, and the group that took them, Tawhid and Jihad, which is Abu Musab Zarqawi's group here, and has cut off Nicholas Berg's head and Kim Sung-il, a Korean, a few days ago, as sort of propaganda murders, if you will, know that whatever limited support they have in the Arab world would be severely undermined by doing the same sort of thing to other Muslims. They style themselves defenders of Muslims.
But the Lebanese-American Marine Corporal Wasif Ali Hassoun and the Pakistani driver who are being held and threatened with beheading are also Muslim.
It's very interesting. Well, we're going to have to, you know, particularly the case of the Lebanese-American Marine, what these folks do with them. It's also not clear, you know, there are a number of different hostage-taking groups here which sometimes have similar motivations, but not identical motivations, and certainly not the same command and control. Hopefully those people will be released as well. We're just going to have to watch and see how it develops.
Yeah. And just briefly, do we know the status of the American soldier kidnapped in April, Keith Maupin? Al Jazeera said it had footage of him being shot. In the few seconds we have, do we know if that's true?
It's looking quite likely that it's true. There hasn't been firm confirmation out of the U.S. military yet, but it seems likely, and Al Jazeera has consistently gotten good information on these sorts of things.
Well, Dan, thank you.
Thank you.
Dan Murphy is correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. He spoke to us from Baghdad. Hundreds of Cuban Americans are braving unusually long airport lines in Miami ahead of new travel restrictions to Cuba. Starting tomorrow, Cubans in the U.S. will be limited to 1 family visit to Cuba every 3 years, instead of the current policy allowing for annual visits. And those U.S. residents not back in the country by August 1st face a $7,000 fine. The new restrictions also affect the amount of money visitors can legally spend in Cuba or send to family in Cuba and the amount of baggage they can bring. Non-Cuban Americans are also affected by travel restrictions. Educational visits under 10 weeks are being curtailed, and high school students won't be allowed to study on the island. Richard Brand is covering the angle of the Cuban families trying to get to Cuba. He's with the Miami Herald, and he's on the line now. Richard, tell us, what's the scene like at the airport there?
There are certainly large crowds, many people who would like to visit their relatives in Cuba before the restrictions go into effect. Many of these people have mothers, siblings, cousins that they care about, that they've been providing for in the form of remittances and in the form of clothing and other products that they bring back on these travels. And they're very worried about how their relatives are going to fare without the frequent trips.
Now, do we understand that the remittances have also been restricted, or are they just restricted by the trip itself?
No, the remittances are being restricted as well. Right now, there is a limit of several hundred dollars per month of remittances to family members in Cuba, and that limit is being reduced. As well, it's being reduced to the number of family members that it can be, that remittances can be sent to. Mm. Now, those types of remittances can only be sent to next of kin.
Well, what is the Bush administration is saying is the thinking behind this, and how are people responding to that?
The Bush administration is hoping that these restrictions will hasten the fall of Cuban President Fidel Castro's communist government. The ironic thing is that by pushing many of these people out of the country, he's providing a lifeline for himself, because many of these people who he's forced out are sending money back to the island in the form of dollars, and those remittances are the lifeline of the Cuban economy. Mm. So the hope is by cutting into that, they can hurt the Castro government and hasten its fall.
Well, and you have talked to people who've said that the only people that these restrictions hurt are the Cuban people themselves, the family members of these people who now live in Florida and won't be able to travel as much and won't be able to send as much money back. This is a political year. This is a presidential election year. What are they saying in terms of their support for Bush?
That's absolutely true. There's a deep split in the Cuban American community in South Florida about these restrictions. A large group of Cubans are very upset about the restrictions, and look, they've seen the Cuban embargo and how many years it's been in effect, and they've lost faith in policy towards Cuba. Cuban Americans have largely backed Republican presidential candidates in past years. Now you're seeing Democrats sort of smelling blood in the water and seizing on this issue as an opportunity to siphon some of those reliably Republican votes. When I went to the airport the other day, I spoke to several people in line who said that they had voted for Bush in 2000, but because of these restrictions, they plan to vote for John Kerry in this upcoming election.
And meantime, those who are traveling this week have until 12:01 a.m. August 1st to come back, or they won't be allowed back in.
That's correct. Originally, as the rules had been published, the deadline was going to be June 30th. Then they extended the deadline so that if you left before June 30th, you had until the 1st of August to get back onto U.S. territory.
And meantime, it'll be another 3 years before these people who are now at the airport can go see their family.
That's right. That's right. You know, you could hear the distress in their voices when they would talk about this. They said, look, I have a mother who's 80 years old. You know, it's a very difficult situation to be in, where potentially you could have a family member who has a crisis or an emergency and you can't go and be with them.
Richard Brand, thank you.
Thank you very much for having me.
Richard Brand, reporter for the Miami Herald, speaking to us from Miami. A poll out today indicates that both George Bush and John Kerry are having trouble connecting with the electorate. The New York Times CBS poll shows Bush's popularity has fallen to 42%, the lowest it's been during his presidency. But nearly 40% of voters surveyed don't know who John Kerry is, and many of those who do don't like him. The Democratic Convention begins a month from now in Boston's Fleet Center, and joining us on the line is Alice Huffman, chair of the 2004 Democratic National Convention Committee. In fact, Alice, you're at the Fleet Center right now. How's it going?
Oh, it's going well. It's a transformation going on here like you wouldn't believe. It's really, really invigorating.
Well, as you know, it is also of some concern to people who work in the city, because it's really going to put the city on its ear in a couple of weeks. And many ask, did the party make a mistake picking the Fleet Center, which is in the heart of Boston, over the South Boston Convention Center out on the waterfront, as Republican Governor Mitt Romney and others, they were lobbying for that, because so many city workers are going to be inconvenienced by the convention?
Well, actually, no, we did not. It was a deliberate decision. We always use stadiums. Convention centers don't provide the environment that we want. It's flat. Right. And no, we're not sorry that we selected the Fleet Center. We knew it had challenges, and we were confident that those challenges would be overcome.
Are you worried that, you know, that there really aren't going to be a lot of people around the convention because of security concerns are being pushed way back? Some people think that's the best part of a convention.
Well,
you know,
the protesters that respect each other's rights to protest is the first part of the convention, but I think closer to the Fleet Center, there will be an area for the protesters so they can be seen. But I think once inside the Fleet Center, we'll be back to our convention community.
Let's talk about the polls I was just sharing with you. The latest show that a lot of people don't know John Kerry, and some who do don't like him. What can you do at a convention to counter that?
Well, I think, first of all, when the nation and the world has a chance to hear John Kerry make his acceptance speech, rather, I am confident that once they hear John Kerry, that they will like him because he's a man of substance and courage, and he will be able to communicate that to the people.
You're also surrounding him with some of the most popular people in the party. Details about the speaker lineup came out yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
Bill Clinton will be speaking on the first night,
mm-hmm.
Senator Kennedy on the second, the vice president, whoever he may be, on the third.
Or she.
Well, is that a hint?
Day. No. One day in our lives, since this is two women talking.
then John Kerry. But the question arises, where's Al Gore?
Mm-hmm.
Some are worried that Al Gore was sent out to be sort of the pit bull of the campaign, and yet he's not going to be good enough for prime time.
Well, he's good enough for prime time. It's just that prime time is not what it used to be, and there's only so many slots. Mm-hmm. He's good enough for prime time. We love Al Gore. And I am sure that he'll be as close to prime time as we can get.
I want to talk about another issue that's been reported quite extensively, as you know. You were on the search committee before you were appointed the head of the convention. At one of the first meetings in Boston, you reportedly asked the question, where are the black faces? You were soon after appointed head of the committee. What do you say to those who suggest that that was a token appointment, you know, to appease the black community, because this, in fact, is still an all-white show?
Well, it is not an all-white show. You just haven't been over to look at our convention staff. First of all, it is totally diverse, the best in the history of this country. So I don't, just because I'm African-American, I don't think I'm token. I think I'm qualified and I'm doing a good job.
Well, but, you know, I'm looking at an all-white male lineup of speakers so far. And you raised another question. Where are the women? Are any women going to speak?
Oh, heavens yes. There are women speaking all over the place. You just wait till you get the rest of the lineup. But I'm going to tell you this about these white men. You can't find a man who's worked harder for equal rights than Senator Kennedy. And, I mean, you don't have to be black to have respect of people of color. And you don't have to be black to be a part of our community. Now, he's got a white face, but God knows that ain't the worst thing that ever happened in this world.
Alice Huffman, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Alice Huffman, chair of the 2004 Democratic National Convention Committee. Well, just ahead, big conventions pose huge security challenges to city officials and residents. And later, if an American corporation were a person, what kind of person would it be? There's more coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Commuters in Boston are trying to figure out how to get to work during the Democratic convention. 40 miles of highway will be shut down convention week.
Is your driving going to be affected when the convention comes?
Of course, most definitely. How are we going to get there? We have to take the highway. There's only one main highway unless we go down and around. I mean, but still, there's no main highway.
And North Station, the popular train depot underneath the Fleet Center where the convention will be held, will be closed. We recently ran for the train with commuters as they thought about alternatives. Many were from nearby Mass General Hospital.
You guys really can't take a vacation.
No, not really. I mean, we're going to be canceling elective surgeries and that sort of thing, but obviously we have to remain open.
This will be the final boarding call for the 5:30 train to Southland.
I'm going to be actually moving down with a friend to the South Shore and commuting from the South Shore instead of the North Shore.
You're going to move?
For the week, yeah.
Have you thought how you're going to commute to work during the convention?
By hook or crook. Actually, I'm taking that week off for vacation because I don't want to be involved in it.
Have you thought how you'll get to work during the convention?
Staying home. Okay. So is our whole department.
I think I'll just avoid it the whole week.
I'm taking time off because I can't get to work.
I'm going to go through the South Side, through South Station.
I'm not going to come in.
Just stay home?
Stay at home. I'm the boss.
Meanwhile, over at the T, the above and below ground rail trolley that services Boston, new security regulations have just been announced. No bikes, no backpacks, and the North Station stop will be closed.
I take buses, and buses are usually slow, so.
I figure when I get to the station the morning of whatever, I'll find out then.
I was hoping to take a bicycle from where I live, and now it looks like that may not be possible.
The travel restrictions are all for security, this being the first presidential nominating convention since 9/11. We decided to visit MIT, the university which looks at Boston from the other side of the Charles River, to ask architecture professor Bill Mitchell about the effects of security on a city. Mitchell says cities are voluntary organizations founded on trust. You trust someone to stop at a stop sign, and terrorists try to undermine that trust. We began our walk along some Jersey barriers.
This is what people think of when they think of security.
Yeah. It's part of it. It's a very simple, crude part of security, but it does prevent the movement of vehicles. So, you know, it has terrible urban design effect because they're incredibly ugly and cause all kinds of other problems, but they're a quick, simple response to preventing the movement of vehicles.
What do they do to the psyche of a city?
Oh, I think they do terrible things for the psyche of a city, because a city is fundamentally about bringing people together, about freedom of access, freedom of movement, freedom of assembly, and these kind of overt symbols of not being able to do that are really just terrible things for a city, I think. I mean, it's inevitable. It's completely understandable, but the symbolic effect is terrible.
I see a beautiful city. As somebody who's concerned with urban security, what do you see?
Yeah, it's a gorgeous city, absolutely spectacular. Well, one of the problems Boston has, of course, is the problem of access. Exiting, getting large crowds out of an area. Boston is a very, very difficult city to do that in.
Well, the Fleet Center is located in the North End, one of the most congested, lovely neighborhoods. It's an Italian neighborhood of Boston, but it is one of the most congested. But there are main arteries leading out of the Fleet Center, and they will be closed.
Well, closing up the main arteries does give you some better chance to organize quick egress, actually.
What are some of your other thoughts about urban security as we look at the Fleet Center and the center of the city?
Well, one of the difficulties with old cities is that there are lots of places to conceal bombs, to conceal all kinds of things. And things that make a city wonderful, make a city picturesque, lots of little nooks and crannies, this is precisely what, of course, makes a city insecure. So I think one of the big issues always is, how do you find the right kind of balance? How do you get an appropriate level of security without destroying the character and quality of a city that, you know, is the attraction in the first place? I mean, modern cities have enormous infrastructures, and any of these things, in principle, can be used to import destruction into a city and import violence into a city. Electrical supply networks, it's computer networks, it's air supply networks, it's water networks. Air conditioning network or an air supply network in a building, unfortunately, is a perfect distribution system for airborne toxins.
So what do you do? I mean, the city can't shut down the air conditioning in the Fleet Center.
No, you can't. I mean, I think this is the fundamental thing that people have to recognize, that there are fundamental limits to what you can do, particularly in the short term, to make a city secure. Since, in fact, a modern city is built on the principle of permeability and networks that bring all kinds of things into the city and concentrate them in the city. I mean, that's just fundamentally what the city is. And if you did negate all of that, you wouldn't have a city anymore.
Anything good that people like yourself concerned about security are learning?
Yeah, well, one of the fundamental things about urban security is that in many ways, people are the best security. So you know, populated public spaces tend to be safe spaces. People take responsibility for their space, you know, for their home space, and that's really what it comes down to. Technology can help, of course, but you can't just rely on technological solutions. You can't rely on bureaucratic solutions or law enforcement solutions. These all help, and they're part of it. But in the end, the citizens of a city have to say, this is our home, we're going to treat it as our home, and we're going to protect it.
As you know, people are being told to stay home, go on vacation, don't go to work.
Yeah.
Is that the right approach to take?
I think it's a very sad kind of response. It may be a pragmatic reality. It may be the only thing that you know, can work in the short term in Boston right now. But if you contrast that with the ancient Greek idea of the city and the citizenry and the idea of the agora at the center of the city, which was a place where all the citizenry can come together, it's, I think, just a disaster for democracy.
Professor Bill Mitchell, he teaches architecture at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The Supreme Court is wrapping up its term by releasing two more decisions today, one of them concerning children and access to internet porn. The High Court ruled that a law passed in 1998, but which never took effect, the Child Online Protection Act, is unconstitutional because it calls for filtering objectionable online material from the eyes of children. And that, justices say, may violate the free speech rights of adults. Joining us on the line from the press room of the U.S. Supreme Court is veteran court reporter Lyle Denniston. Lyle, we understand this was a close decision, but what are the justices saying?
They're saying explicitly that Congress did not take into account adequately the possibility that users of computers like parents could stop their children from seeing material that Congress thinks is objectionable for children by using filtering or blocking software. The court has also made it very clear that the facts about the existing software in this case are very much out of date because those are 1998 facts. And so when the case returns to a lower court, the parties on both sides are going to have to advise the court on what new factual developments have occurred. And it's very difficult, I think, for the government to make the point that the filtering and blocking software has not improved enough. And the court clearly prefers the use of that kind of software to the use of severe criminal penalties as a way of trying to insulate children from seeing sexually explicit material on the web.
So this is, you say it's going back, so this is the third time the Supremes have taken up the issue, and it may not be the last. Let's move to their next decision. They released another one this morning. It's complicated. They ruled against a Mexican doctor who sued after he was kidnapped by bounty hunters paid by American agents in Mexico for assisting in the torture of an American drug agent. Now, the judges weren't ruling today on what he did, assisting in that torture, but on whether or not he could sue. What did they say?
Well, they said he could not sue for damages because this is not the kind of injury that occurs overseas for which U.S. law provides a remedy in American courts. The court has interpreted two laws, one of which, by the way, dates all the way from 1789, to be fairly narrow in scope. And so the court appears to have put almost a complete stop to a series of rising number of lawsuits brought by foreign persons in American courts to try to collect damages for wrongs that occurred outside this country's borders.
Mm. Very briefly, in just the couple seconds we have, the court term ended with no announcements of retirements.
No, there were no retirements today. As a matter of fact, those who hang around the court regularly had not expected any, because it's something of a tradition around the court that a justice, if he or she has a choice about it, will not quit in the presidential election year, because there's almost no chance, with the Senate divided as closely as it is, for a successor to be approved. So anybody who tried to quit this spring would still have to serve in the fall, because a successor would not be available, and justice would not like to leave the court shorthanded.
Hmm. Well, Lyle, thank you so much. Reporter Lyle Denniston, he was speaking to us from the press room of the U.S. Supreme Court. There's a showdown in Colorado over water. Whitewater parks are the rage in towns like Golden, Colorado, which successfully sued the state to give towns using water for recreation the same rights as farmers and the suburbs. But is this the best way to use this precious resource? Journalist Bruce Barcott writes about the debate in the current issue of Legal Affairs magazine. He joins us on the line. And Bruce, one line jumped out of your article immediately. You quote a professor on a saying about water in the West.
There's an old saying, there's one saying in the West that whiskey's for drinking and water's for fighting, and nowhere is that more true than the state of Colorado. But one professor took it even further. He said there's an old saying in Colorado, you can steal my wife, but not my water.
And he teaches water law, which also struck us, but it's something that's being called on quite a bit because of this current controversy. Tell us first, what is a whitewater park?
Whitewater Park is essentially a playground for kayakers. What you do is you take a stretch of creek and you put a bunch of boulders and concrete berms in, and it's all very high-tech. There are actually engineers who specialize in creating these things. And when you're done, you've got a mile-long stretch of river that is highly enticing to kayakers who hopefully, city officials, if they do it right, those kayakers come, and then they spend money in local restaurants, bars, gas stations, and that sort of thing.
And just a quick question, why don't they want to go on the river?
The rivers don't have as many sort of specially made waterfalls, boiling holes, nice little eddies to run.
But Colorado has the Rockies with huge ice packs, so why isn't there enough water? What's the controversy?
There isn't enough water because mainly a lot of Colorado's water is claimed by other states. I mean, Colorado has seven major rivers originating in the state, but it has a lot of it's a signatory to a number of river compacts that essentially pledge a lot of that water to downstream states and even to Mexico. So there's not a whole lot left for the state of Colorado. And what is there is in the wrong place. 85% of the water goes down the western half of the Rockies, but 90% of the population is in the eastern half.
And in fact, cities like Colorado Springs are saying that they're going to outgrow their current water supply in 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where this battle comes. Explain to me, who's fighting whom, and what do you think the outcome's going to be?
In that battle, Colorado Springs is fighting the town of Pueblo. Colorado Springs has all the population growth and no water, and Pueblo has all the water and no population growth. So essentially, Colorado Springs wants to go down to Pueblo, run a big pipeline down there, and take what Pueblo considers its water. Pueblo is fighting back in a number of ways, one of which is by building its own kayak course and trying to lock up a lot of the water in the Arkansas River that Colorado Springs wants.
Because law has just been passed allowing recreation rights to be the same as development rights.
Exactly, exactly. Okay. They haven't come to blows yet, but actually there's one assistant city attorney in Pueblo once threatened to arrest any water engineer from Colorado Springs who came on city property.
So essentially towns are built that might never have thought of it before are now wanting to build kayak parks so that they can get water.
Right. And, you know, I think most of them are legitimately building kayak parks in order to spruce up their towns and get a lot of this recreation business. But there are, you know, a lot of forces in Colorado water circles that think there's a lot of mischief going on, as one of them told me, in terms of using kayak courses to lock up those water rights.
Right. What do you think is going to happen in the long run, just briefly, Bruce?
I think the water will probably end up going to the suburbs. That's where the money is. That's where the power is. I think in cases like Pueblo, they will get a certain amount of water for their kayak course, but it probably won't be near what they want.
Well, Bruce, thank you.
You're welcome.
Bruce Barcott is contributing editor to Outside Magazine. His article, "You Can Steal My Wife But Not My Water," is in the current issue of Legal Affairs magazine. Still to come, in a new documentary, two filmmakers offer their psychological profile of the American corporation. You're listening to Here and Now. Fahrenheit 9/11, Michael Moore's scathing indictment of the Bush administration, opened this weekend and became the highest-grossing documentary of all time. There is, of course, much controversy surrounding the movie, including its title. Author Ray Bradbury has been vocal about his disappointment that Moore borrowed from the title of Bradbury's 1953 Fahrenheit 451, the prescient tale about book burning and mind control in a futuristic society that had full-screen TVs on the wall and radios on our heads. Well, Ray Bradbury's protest is as good a reason as any to spend a minute with the 84-year-old author. Welcome, Mr. Bradbury.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you. What are your objections to Moore's use of the title? Some might say it's a nice homage.
I found out about this in Variety magazine 6 months ago. I called Variety. I said, "What's going on? I don't understand this." And they gave me Michael Moore's phone number, his company. And I called them and I said, "Why haven't you been in touch? What are you doing?" They said, "Well, Michael Moore will call you this afternoon." He never called. Hmm. So I think not only is he a thief, but he's an impolite thief.
Well, we have heard that Michael Moore also says that 451 is the temperature at which books burn and 9/11 is the temperature at which freedom burns.
Well, that's a metaphorical concept of his. It has nothing to do with my book, you see.
Yeah, and explain for those who have a hazy memory of the book, the concept of book burning and firefighters as it was laid out in your book.
Well, in the future, I imagine the firemen, having nothing to do, would be given the job of going around and finding books and burning them.
And, of course, this was part of an attempt in the book to sort of mind control and take away information from people.
It's partially true. The main failure, which is described in the book, is the failure of school teachers, of educators, to teach children to read and write, starting in the kindergarten and the first grade. So if you don't teach them to read and write, when they get older, you don't have to burn the books because they don't need the book.
Well, you know, some today would draw an analogy between your concept of book burning and education and what they see now as an attempt to control information, you know, the Patriot Act, the fight that librarians have fought against parts of the Patriot Act. And they see that connection between your book and what Michael Moore is doing.
It's a false connection. It's one that he's made, and he's trying to connect my book to his project, and I don't want to be connected to his project.
Well, let me ask you something. Why don't you want to be connected? Does it have to do with your politics?
No. It has to do with him being a thief.
There's a new edition of your book out with a new question and answer in it. You were asked in that book, and I'd like to ask you again, if you think the country is indeed moving closer to the fictional America that you wrote about 50 years ago. Do you think it is?
In some ways, our main failure is education. We are not teaching reading and writing in the kindergarten and the first grade. But other things happened that were even more amazing. I thought I would be an old man when we went to the moon. Mm. And by God, I was only 49 years old. A wonderful accomplishment. And more young authors are having a chance to be heard. So that's all very positive.
One last question. You are understandably unhappy, but I'm guessing that the sale of your books is going to go up because of the film. One positive side effect.
Well, I hope so, and I hope this film sinks away and is forgotten.
So far, your book has, you know, had 50 years on it and hasn't been.
No, my book is still in all the schools, which makes me very happy.
Ray Bradbury, thank you so much.
Shirley, thank you. Mm-hmm. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Author Ray Bradbury, more ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Think for a second. If a corporation was a person, what kind of person do you think it would be?
General Electric is a kind old man with lots of stories.
Nike.
Young.
Energetic.
Microsoft. Aggressive.
McDonald's. Young, outgoing, enthusiastic.
Monsanto. Immaculately dressed.
Disney. Goofy.
The Body Shop. Deceptive.
In this award-winning documentary, The Corporation, the case is made that if a corporation was a person, it would be a psychopath. The evidence? A renowned diagnostic test and interviews with dozens of thinkers, corporate leaders, and whistleblowers. Throw in arresting animation, archival footage, and a 19th-century law that says American corporations are artificial persons, entitled to the same rights and responsibilities as you or I.
Imperial Steel Incorporated has many of the legal rights of a person. It can buy and sell property. It can borrow money. It can sue in court and be sued. It carries on a business. Imperial Steel, along with thousands of other legal persons, is a part of our daily living. It is a member of our society.
And a monstrous member of society, at least according to filmmakers Mark Akbar and Joel Bakken, who join us from Carnegie Studios in New York City. Thanks, you guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Boy, that's a big ouch, saying that corporations today are psychopaths. You use the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders to come to this conclusion. Can you tick off, Joel, some of the reasoning behind your theory?
Well, it's actually, I think, a relatively analytically sound metaphor, though it is a bit inflammatory to call corporations psychopaths. But, you know, a human psychopath is a person that's incapable of caring for others. And one of the first principles you learn in corporate law is that the corporation is deemed by the law to be a person. The second principle is that the law requires the corporation always to act in its own self-interest. So making the connection, if this were a human person, we would likely diagnose it as a psychopath.
Because some of the telltale behaviors of a psychopath, as designated by the World Health Organization, callous unconcern for the feelings of others, an incapacity to maintain enduring relationships, reckless disregard for the safety of others.
And as we point out in the book and the film, we sort of use examples to illustrate how those characteristics are ones that corporations exhibit in their behavior.
Mark, can you give us a few of those examples?
Well, we look at sweatshop labor conditions. We look at the impact of corporations on the environment, on animals. We look at the impact of some of their products on populations, Agent Orange, for example. Monsanto settled out of court with some victims, but never admitted guilt, and the inability to experience guilt is also a feature of psychopathic behavior.
Well, you start the film with a series of clips of various business, you know, professionals and journalists talking about the few bad apples.
The media debate about the basic operating principles of the corporate world was quickly reduced to a game of follow the leader.
I still happen to think the United States is the greatest place in the world to invest. We have some shakeups that are going on because of a few bad apples.
At the time of the Enron WorldCom debacle, I just felt compelled to start recording off air what was going on. And there was one particular statement by George Bush where he tried to defend the errant corporations as simply bad apples in an otherwise healthy barrel. And just looking through, I probably gathered about 30 hours of news coverage of this, and there a pattern evolved where every news commentator just kind of fell in line following the Bush comment talking about bad apples, bad apples, bad apples, bad apples, and we just cut those together one after another, and it becomes quite a comical sequence, actually.
These are not just a bunch of bad apples.
This is just a few bad apples.
It's not just a few bad apples.
We've got to get rid of the bad apples.
You can start with Tyco.
Bad apples.
We know all about WorldCom.
Bad apples.
Xerox Corporation.
Bad apples.
Arthur Anderson.
Bad apples.
Enron, obviously.
Bad apples.
Kmart Corporation.
The fruit cart is getting a little more full.
I don't think it's just a few apples, unfortunately. I think this is the worst crisis of confidence in business.
What's wrong with this picture?
Why isn't this just a few bad apples? Why do you think that this is corporation-wide?
Well, I think it goes to the very question of what is a corporation as an institution. And our purpose in this film is to try to move away from the sort of usual media treatment of corporations and looking at different individuals and what they've done wrong and whatnot. We really want to look at the institution as a whole. And I come at this as a lawyer and my interest in the corporation as a legal institution. And the fact that we as a society have created this institution and programmed it so that it always has to serve its own self-interest. And we've then given it immense power. And that, to me, is interesting and worthy of investigation.
Right. Film festivals have been embracing the film, and its audiences have been embracing it. But as you know, there have been some critics who say, and I'll address this to you, Mark, that it sounds as if you're making corporations responsible for everything that is wrong in the world.
You know, that's certainly never stated in the film. I think we look at some very specific harms through several case studies and through interviews with people who've been adversely affected by corporations. You know, it's not a total entity. It's this one institution that we're looking at, although we do point out how pervasive corporate influence is over every aspect of our lives. They're hard to escape from the minute you wake up and put a branded tooth-cleaning product in your mouth to the minute you, go to sleep on, probably sweatshop-woven sheets. It's there with us in everything we do.
But as one of your critics has pointed out, it's also there in filmmaking. Terrence Corcoran of Canada's Financial Post, I know you've had quite a back and forth with him in the paper, he called you corporate welfare recipients because you commented on the corporate sponsors in your acceptance speech for the Audience Award at the Sundance Film Festival. You made similar comments at the Independent Film Festival here in Boston. But you also, as filmmakers, rely on corporations for sponsoring film festivals that help you get your word out. So do we have ourselves to blame as well for our reliance on corporations?
You know, it's pretty hard to escape the corporate world. And certainly in my comments at Sundance, it was a sort of backhanded thank you to the corporate sponsors. I actually said that despite the fact that the institution was psychopathic, that we were nevertheless grateful for the support.
Right.
I think it's very important to point out that among the business press, that article is probably the only one that has been so vehemently critical towards us. We can, counter it with articles from the Wall Street Journal, The Economist, the USA Today Money section, Fast Company, Wired, the Harvard Business Review, all of which treat the book and the film very respectfully and engage its ideas in a very respectful way.
Well, Mark Akbar and Joel Bakken, it looks as if your film and book are going to be a big success. Simon & Schuster apparently has picked up the book. What happens as you now walk down this trail? I mean, do you try to change the companies that you work with?
You know, I mean, I think it's like in any dominant system, whether it's the monarchy that dominates or the Communist Party or the corporation that dominates, you're always stuck in this dilemma that the only way that you can do anything is through the institutions that exist. But at the same time, what you're doing is you're criticizing those institutions. And it seems to me, you know, we have two options. We can either shut up because we risk hypocrisy, because we're relying on, you know, the very institutions we're criticizing. Or we can understand that historically, this is the only way that people have been able to confront power and confront authority and try to make the world a better place and carry on despite what appear to be the contradictions that are inevitable when you do that.
Well, I want to thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Filmmakers Mark Akbar and Joel Bakken talking about their new documentary, The Corporation. It opens in New York City tomorrow. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Get into your radio and join us again, Here and Now. For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.